From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made tomorrow night in Cleveland, where 10 Republican presidential candidates get on stage to debate for the first time. Today, Fox News revealed the final list. They used a polling formula to decide which 10 candidates are in and which 7 candidates are out. The 7 that did not make the cut will debate in a kind of undercard event at 5 p.m. tomorrow. So here's the list of candidates who made the final cut for the main event tomorrow. Donald Trump, Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Mike Huckabee, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Chris Christie, and John Kasich. Those who didn't: Rick Perry, Rick Santorum, Bobby Jindal, Carly Fiorina, Lindsey Graham, George Pataki, and Jim Gilmore. Now, a few weeks ago, we hosted a panel that discussed the Democratic presidential race. Today, we look at the GOP side, which is a far more crowded field for now. My guests for the hour include Jesse Sleaser, leader of the Irondequoit Republican Committee. Nice to have you here, Jesse. You're on.
Thanks, Evan. Good to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
Tom Hebert is a Greece native. He's the treasurer of College Republicans at American University, studying political science, and nice to have you here, Tom.
Pleasure to be here, Evan. Thank you so much.
And Tim Nealon, chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. Always nice to have you here, sir.
Good to be here.
All right. Well, I want to make it very clear. I don't intend to do the entire hour on Donald Trump, thankfully for everyone's sanity. But something interesting is happening. Trump is now... I would say he's dominating the national polls to the extent that you can dominate any poll with a plurality. But he is. He's leading in New Hampshire. He's leading national polls. And yesterday, Chris Saliza of The Washington Post wrote a piece titled, "Boy, Was I Wrong About Donald Trump." And I want to read what he wrote and get our panel's reaction. Quote, this is what Saliza says. Quote, "I am the person who wrote a piece dismissing the Donald as even a semi-serious candidate for the presidency. My reasoning was pretty straightforward. Trump was regarded incredibly negatively by Republican voters. 23% of GOP voters held a favorable opinion of Trump in a May Washington Post poll. 65% viewed him negatively. 11% of Republicans felt strongly favorably toward Trump. 43% strongly negatively. At the time, I wrote that you cannot and do not win anything when your numbers look like Trump's. Republicans know Trump, and they really, really don't like him. But then opinions about Trump among the GOP totally flipped. That same Washington Post poll showed Trump at 23-65 in his favorable unfavorables suddenly revealed an absolutely unprecedented change in Trump's favor in July. In the newest poll, 57% of Republicans now view him favorably, 40% unfavorably. Why did I miss Trump's appeal so badly? Simply put, I had never, ever seen a reversal in how people perceive a candidate who is as well-known as he is, much less a reversal in such a short period of time. But it is happening, and point taken, never say never in politics." That's Chris Saliza in The Washington Post. So, Jesse Sleaser, is there, at this point, is there a real chance that Donald Trump is your party's nominee?
Well, I think in a field with that many challengers, there's always going to be a chance, Evan. But I would say this, and I'm actually very happy that you went with that article, because there was a follow-up article to that on the Washington Post online version today. And I don't remember who exactly was the author on the byline, but they had followed up with Nate Silver from the 538 blog.
Yep.
And essentially, Nate was unwilling to concede what Chris had
he's
yesterday.
Not budging on this.
Not budging. And I think I've been having a hard time expressing why I don't think that Trump has the lasting power to stick around. But I think a couple of things that Nate shared in that kind of solidify for me what are those reasons. First one, Trump is polling artificially high right now, at least in terms of the way I would see it. And part of that reason is he has built-in name ID that a lot of these other candidates don't. It comes from years of his entertainment and marketing prowess. His name ID is pre-established. One of the things that is, I still think, a problem, despite that quote that you just mentioned, his unfavorables are pretty high for a Republican primary with Republicans. That's not going to change. Donald Trump is a known quantity for the Republican electorate right now. As some of those other candidates gain name ID, their positions become known, I think his polling standing in the field will change a little bit. And the third thing that really can't be ignored is the establishment does not appreciate Donald Trump in the race. And, you know, as much as they're having an opposition candidate out there can garner some grassroots support, that institutional support matters, and it will matter in early states where you need a ground game. Now, sure, he has the resources to be able to make it up. He has the resources to be able to put his own team together, but it makes it much easier, even if it's not formal establishment support. As long as you don't have establishment opposition, you're probably going to be okay. And so I think those reasons are the main reasons I would say that I'm not convinced at this time that Donald Trump is a thing that's going to last.
To Jesse's point, still 40% unfavorable, and he has the highest number in the field when you ask Republican voters who is a candidate who you would never vote for. Trump is at the highest level there. So some credence to what Jesse is saying. Tom, what do you make of Trump right now?
You know, Trump is interesting because he's doing everything that the GOP establishment doesn't want him to do, and he's succeeding. I mean, he bashed John McCain as not a war hero. He said that all Mexican immigrants are druggers and rapists and all this.
He didn't
kind
say
of, like,
all.
Most.
He implied
he said,
a lot.
You know, some are good people. That's
it's
what he
weird
said.
That I'm defending Donald Trump, but go ahead.
And the thing with Donald Trump is he's tapping into this angry electorate that is just fed up with the Washington establishment, fed up with effete candidates that don't like to attack Democrats. And he's really doing well because of it. I think that once we start to see the debates, a lot of people will tune in to see Trump, but not a lot of people will stick around for Trump because I really don't think that he has a lot of substantive policy ideas.
Well, let's listen, and then we'll get Tim Nealon's take. This is Donald Trump talking about ISIS. If we could listen, this is at CPAC, I think. So, Val, this is the Donald Trump on ISIS cut. Let's listen to Donald Trump, and this is, to Tom's point, some people think this sounds great. Some people think this is not quite substantive enough.
Nobody would be tougher than Donald Trump. Nobody. I would hit them so hard and so fast that they wouldn't know what happened. I would find a general. Remember the old days of General MacArthur and General Patton and these great generals. Now, we must have somebody in there. But I laugh as I say, and it's laugh through tears, as you say, look, they're announcing when they're going to attack the other side. How often do you see that? In 2 weeks from now, we're sending soldiers over here. We're going to attack this. General MacArthur is spinning in his grave when he sees what we do. So you got to hit him hard. You got to hit him firm. And you can't play games.
All right, Tim Nealon, chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. That rhetoric is appealing to about a quarter, which is the most of any candidate in the early GOP states. He's leading in New Hampshire. He's doing pretty well in Iowa.
Yeah, but let's not forget who's got all the air in the room. Let's not forget that poll numbers are also driven by media coverage, and the media is following the Donald around. They're hoping he's going to say something stupid. They print it, and then it turns out that what he's saying is red meat for the base. And I really think that both the comments today reflect the reality that Donald Trump is not in it to stay. He doesn't really have the organization on the ground. He just makes things up as he goes along. He doesn't really have deep policy issues. I think the problem for the GOP is that he's on that stage tonight, which gives him a kind of legitimacy that he normally wouldn't have. So he's one of the 10. I think actually it helps people like Rick Perry, though, not to be on the same stage with Donald, because whoever wins the second tier debate tonight, they're going to go up in poll numbers. So I really think, you know, Donald Trump, it's summer. People aren't paying as much attention. It's the silly season, as we used to call it, going into the more serious post-Labor Day as we start to buckle down. I think, you know, these debates that we see, these pre-primary debates, do sort of weed people out, and there'll be some people falling away. You know, Donald can stay as long as Donald is got the money. He's got the money for this. But again, Donald, we didn't really know the Donald. What do we know the Donald? He said, you're fired. You know, he saw people crying in limos.
People need Tim.
But I think as people hear his comments and then how he changes his tone, let's build a wall, let's not build a wall, right? I mean, they're going to realize that he's really not the kind of guy that could carry through. And then I think his candidates begin to attack him and shred his image. And, you know, how many bankruptcies has he littered America with, right? I mean, this is the economic genius. No, he's a Donald Trump genius. I think really, we really haven't looked seriously at Donald Trump, and I really don't think we know him. We know the image. We don't know the Donald.
We're not going to spend we're just about done with Donald Trump. I'm
just
going to say that he is leading the poll, so we had to start with him. We're just about done with him. If you're wondering how he would deal with China, because he says he would resurrect MacArthur and send him to go kill ISIS, he would send Carl Icahn to China, and Carl Icahn would convince China to beg forgiveness of America. It's an interesting idea.
Very concrete strategy.
All right, so we're going to move past Donald Trump now, assuming that he's sort of reaching some kind of a ceiling. And if we're wrong, we're wrong, and we'll certainly continue to cover it. But there are a number of candidates, 16 others, and the most likely, if you look at the polls and the money, Tim Neeland, the most likely that your other two panelists are about to disagree with you on is Jeb Bush, yes?
Yes, absolutely. He's the establishment candidate. He's got some chops with the cultural conservatives. I mean, let's not forget the Terri Schiavo case. He won a lot of support from the Christian right when he did that and went to the mat over that case of withdrawing food and water in a really complex situation. And I think that they will remember that when it comes time to vote. So even though he's not maybe the cultural conservative of some of his peers, he's the economic. He's worked for Lehman Brothers. He's been in the private sector. He's been in obviously public office. He was considered the smarter of the Bush brothers. So, you know, and he's fluent in Spanish. You know, I really think he's got some things going for him that as people just try to forget, oh, gee, another Bush, right? I think that he has the ability, the organization, and the funding to take this all the way to the nomination.
So I want to listen to a comment from Jeb Bush and then ask our panel about what I think has become a complex issue early on for the GOP in the nominating states, which is immigration, because so much of the ostensible red meat and sort of the fired up voters in the primary states are upset. They're very guarded about immigration. Donald Trump's rise has sort of coincided with some of his really vitriolic remarks about Mexicans. Then you've got Jeb Bush, his wife, his governance of Florida, his bilingual background. And here's what he said to Sean Hannity during a candidate forum. I want to listen to Jeb Bush talking about immigration.
The plan also includes a path to legal status. I have not seen anybody, and I know there's disagreement here. The simple fact is, there is no plan to deport 11 million people. We should give them a path to legal status where they work, where they don't receive government benefits, where they don't break the law, where they learn English, and where they make a contribution to our society.
All right, so let's go around the table. Tim Neeland, you've got voters who come out for Republican primaries who might not like what they just heard, but most of the analysis from recent presidential elections, 08 and 12 specifically, indicate that the Republicans can't win without stronger Latino support.
Right. I would just say two words, Ronald Reagan. Just Jeb Bush, you invoke Reagan, 1986 immigration reform, you solidify it, and then you tell Congress to fix our broken immigration record, increase the numbers, whatever you need to do, but just stop playing games with this where you look the other way. I think Jeb Bush, that's a winning issue, even with people who are upset about immigration, not just because you're drawing in potential Hispanic voters, but frankly because I think that there is still a conservative and thoughtful electorate who the business community that will support Jeb Bush on something like this.
Jesse Sleaser, he says there is no plan to deport 11 million people. That might hurt him in the primary. That might help him in the general if he can get there. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to discount the advantages that come with being Jeb Bush because they are significant. You know, we talked a little bit about this before we came on air that, you know, he comes with massive name ID. He comes with connections to the family's donor network. He comes with strong institutional support. All these things are very important. You know, I think the question that we have here is that he does have some vulnerabilities in the record, at least as you would perceive them to be in a primary. Primaries are very fickle things. You're dealing with a very small section of the electorate. You're dealing with a very charged portion of the electorate in terms of partisan intensity. You know, those are all things that are going to impact his performance. And I think when you look at litmus test issues that at least appear to be bubbling up right now as those issues that will decide a candidate standing in a close race like this, you're looking at immigration, you're looking at education, you're looking at some of the other things in his record as governor. The real question is, can Jeb's institutional advantages that come along with being Jeb Bush outrun some of those weaknesses inherent in the record? I'm not saying they can't. I just don't necessarily think, if you look back to George W. Bush in 2000, you know, very similar advantages, obviously, coming from the same family, same access to the donor network, same institutional support. But what was a little bit different, at least to me, in that primary was that George W. Bush, if not the most conservative candidate in the primary, was among the top tier of conservative candidates in that primary. He was a clear conservative. That helps in a primary. I don't think that you could look at this field, no matter how many candidates there are in it right now, and say that Jeb is in the top tier of what you would categorize as true conservatives. Now, you know, he will obviously dispute that in the primary. It's going to be important. I'm just not convinced that his institutional advantages outweigh some of those weaknesses in the record.
All right, so let's get you and Tom, because Tim's weighed in. He thinks Jeb is the most likely candidate right now. You say it is not Jeb Bush. It is?
If I had to put money on it right now, I would say it's Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker.
Okay, and tell us why.
Well, I think, you know, we talked a little bit about this before, too, when David Axelrod, who was a senior Obama advisor for a very long time, was with Obama from the beginning, from his rise as state senator up to the U.S. Senate, you know, well-respected voice in politics on both sides of the aisle, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
And Axelrod has a theory on executive elections that, especially when there's no incumbent in the race, voters, the electorate, will tend to gravitate towards what would be a polar opposite paradigm. Candidate. So we saw that in 2008. So, you know, we were winding down with George W. Bush, generally a conservative governing record, generally seen as, you know, more of a, you know, cowboy-esque type presence. And you had this gentleman, you know, from Illinois break on the scene, relatively unknown, very strong personality, almost a cult of personality following him, very different from the incumbent president, much more of an international voice instead of a domestic voice. And that filled that gap that Axelrod was talking about, that a voter was seeking a breath of fresh air at that point. And I think you look at a very similar dynamic here. You know, we've dealt with 8 years of President Obama at this point. We know his record. We don't need to dwell on that. We know some of his strengths. We know some of his weaknesses. I think that Scott Walker is the polar opposite of President Obama for a lot of reasons. We talked about the cult of personality with President Obama. Scott Walker, I think, would be the first to admit his personality is not going to be his carrying factor. You know, I think he's about as exciting as, wheat toast. But, you know, he does come along with, I think, what conservatives and Republican voters in a primary would find a very strong governing record in what was a swing state of Wisconsin. You know, there are certain things as a small government conservative he's going to be able to point to and say, I am ready to play on a big stage, unlike a lot of these candidates can. I think that, you know, you combine Axelrod's theory with the fact that there are so many candidates in this field and executive experience matters, I do think he is the one to rise above and become that natural nominee.
And he, right now, he could easily win Iowa. And if he wins Iowa, the game really changes for him. But how important is it for him to win Iowa? I think that is... He's got to be right near the top in Iowa, if not at the top.
I think it would be a huge setback if he didn't. You know, and again... It's a little bit different with Iowa because you don't necessarily need to be the winner, but you need to be in that top two or three because that's really going to propel you onto South Carolina, onto some of these other states. But it would be I think it would be stunning as well to say if he didn't perform well in Iowa, because to me, you know, the Iowa voter, the Iowa primary voter is looking for a candidate like a Scott Walker. You know, he's not I wouldn't classify him as a social conservative. I wouldn't. I think he's more of an economic conservative. But at the same time, I think he has enough of the social conservative bona fides where he's going to be able to go into a faith and family state like Iowa and really be able to communicate one on one at the pancake dinners, at the state fair, at the places that matter. And that's why I think you combine his record with a natural gap that needs to be filled in terms of this type of candidate, his strong potential performance in the early polls. If I had to put money on it today, I'd say it'd be Scott Walker.
All right, Tom Hebert, you agree, Scott Walker, and what additional reasons do you see?
I think Scott Walker is definitely, if I had to bet today, he would probably be the nominee, and because he's fought principled conservative battles in Wisconsin, and he's won. He's fought battles with the teachers' unions. He's fought battles with other public sector unions. And he's won three elections in 4 years, his two general elections and then his recall election. So I think voters are going to see that. And I watched him at CPAC. I was there at the Conservative Political Action Conference. And going back to what his personality is, I think that, yeah, he's kind of a milquetoast guy right now, but not as milquetoast as Jeb Bush. I think that Scott Walker definitely has the potential to break out of kind of that white bread personality that's not really that appealing, and I think he definitely has a shot at getting the nomination, as long as he keeps building on his personality. He's had a couple gaffes. I was there when he said that he could fight ISIS because he defeated 100,000 union members or something like that. And none of these gaffes have really hurt him. I think he's a folksy, down-to-earth guy that buys sweaters for $1 at Kohl's. And I think that that's going to endear him to a lot of conservatives who are looking for someone that's not part of the political elite, someone that's down-to-earth and someone that can really relate to them. And I think right now that's Scott Walker.
If you want to call the program with our panel talking about the Republican debate tomorrow night, the first official debate of this season, and what to expect going forward, you can call 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You just heard from Tom Hebert. He's a Greece native and treasurer of college Republicans at American University. Tim Nealon's the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College, and Jesse Slezer's here, leader of the Irondequoit Republican Committee. And we'll grab... Oh, in a second, I'm going to grab our first phone call. My board is down. So let me ask. All right, let me just ask the panel one more question then. If it's not Jeb and not Scott Walker, who is the next most likely? You know, a year, well, 4 years ago, we would have been talking about Chris Christie. I don't hear that much anymore. I don't know that Rand Paul's got the support. Marco Rubio, perhaps. Jesse? Most likely, apart from that
most
group.
Likely the next tier. I mean, that's really hard to tell because we're already dealing with a very fluid field already. And then when you start drilling down and, you know, third, fourth place potential candidates, it's difficult to say. Although I think if you not to defer your question, Evan, but I think if you look at this field, it is very different than we're traditionally used to seeing on the Republican side in a presidential primary. You know, I went through just briefly today. I think you have to go all the way back to 1980 with Ronald Reagan, really before there was a clear-cut expected favorite in a Republican primary. I mean, a lot of times, you know, in 2012, we had Mitt Romney, who had finished close to McCain in 2008. In 2008, we had McCain, who had finished close to George W. Bush in 2000. So there's always been a presumptive frontrunner. It's really a wide-open field right now. Some candidates stronger than others? Absolutely. But I think what the field's really lacking is that front runner, which makes it a fluid field. I also think it's a good thing. I do think that this is probably going to provide an opportunity for more issues to be vetted. You're almost dealing with the exact flip side of what we typically see with the Republicans kind of lining up with the next man up approach, and the Democrats, you know, fighting it out a little bit more internally. Well, this year,
yeah, it's interesting.
We have the Democrats more with a next woman up approach, and then we have the Republicans with a wide open field. So I do think it would be difficult for me, I think, right now to say who would be that kind of third tier option, but the process will tell.
I wonder if Beth in Rochester is hoping it's the Ohio governor. We're going to talk about John Kasich in a minute. Beth, you're first up. Go ahead, Beth.
Right. Yeah. But one thing about Bush, he says he wants to get rid of Medicare. I don't know why. But I think that the governor of Ohio has some appeal for the independents and others, more than the governor of Wisconsin.
Beth, I'm glad you brought it up. The governor of Ohio is John Kasich. A lot of people already comparing him to John Huntsman from the last cycle, saying this is another John who has a lot of substance, is very well regarded, just hasn't been able to pick up a lot of traction. But I've got a clip from John Kasich at his presidential announcement speech, and what you find when you hear him is he pushes back a little bit more, whether it's on Trump or he pushes back in a bit of a more of a moderate tone than some of what we're hearing, including talking about police community relations, talking about dealing with unions. He points out he's different than Scott Walker, that he wanted to have, in his words, a better relationship with labor in Ohio, and he thinks he's got it. And here's John Kasich talking about a little story right before he decided he is running for president.
I was just at Wendy's on Saturday up here on Hudson Avenue, and the two wonderful African-American fellows were there, and I walked in. I was standing behind them, and one said to the other one, "I don't know what I believe what I'm seeing, but I think that's Governor Kasich standing behind me." And they said, "You better run." Do you know what that meant to me? Two African-American guys, one with a knee on his leg, a brace on his knee, and another one with a cane. And I said, "Well, you know, people are going to have a lot more money than I am." And they looked at me and they said, "But you got statistics. You got statistics." So some are going to ask, as they always have, "Why do you think you can do this? You know, all of my life, people have told me you can't do something, okay?" And I'll tell you why. It's because I do believe in the power of very big ideas. Together, we'll prove them wrong again, won't we? will prove them wrong again.
It's Governor John Kasich. Tim Nealon, a shot for John Kasich at all?
No. That was a horrible speech. I was falling asleep. I thought, well, are we John Kasich or are we talking George Pataki? Because they sound so much alike in many ways. And look, John Kasich caved on public sector unions there. They're going to remember that. I mean, the conservatives are going to say,
he's
going to
claim
did.
He can reach across the aisle.
Yeah, or, you know, he can be
get,
like every other politician in Washington,
him,
D.C., which is, you know, well, we're going to do this, but until we can't. And that's not what people want, which is why the Donald is doing so well. Or, you know, I mean, obviously they're never going to get what they want, but you got to at least sound like you can deliver. And that's why Walker is getting the chops. And by the way, second tier, let's take another look at Rick Perry and maybe Bobby Jindal. Both governors. I don't think we want another senator. I think you need some, you know, executive. But, you know, Rick Perry learned some pretty harsh lessons in 2012. So he may be ready, and he's coming from Texas, big state, lots of diversity there, and I think, you know, he deserves a second look in the long run.
Okay, Tom, John Kasich, any appeal to young Republicans like yourself?
No. John Kasich.
Oh, this is harsh.
This is the guy who said that God wanted him to expand Medicaid. I just don't see a place for him among millennials. He invokes religion in too many statements. And when he tries to relate, for example, with the African-American community, like we just heard, it just sounds clumsy. I mean, I saw two African-American fellows. I mean, who talks that way? And going back to your second tier question, I think when we answer this question, we have to look at Donald Trump. I don't think he's going to be the second-tier nominee, but we have to look at who's not denouncing him, and that's Ted Cruz. Mm. Ted Cruz has said, Donald Trump, he's bold, he's brash, I love what he's saying. He's the only GOP candidate that's not attacking Donald Trump, because he knows, somewhere down the line, I don't know what it is, I don't know if you guys know what it is, something that Donald Trump says or does is going to sink his campaign, and Ted Cruz is going to scoop up all those supporters, all that 25%. And I think that's going to make Ted Cruz a very, very potent force going down the road here.
All right, well, let's get a short break, and when we come back, you're going to hear a clip from Ted Cruz. If you haven't heard much from him, he's often referred to as the best debater in the field and one of the best public speakers in the field. You can judge for yourself when we come back. We've got a clip from his announcement for president as we talk to our panel about the likely GOP nominee. Not that there is a single likely one yet. The debate tomorrow night in Cleveland. Your phone calls and comments as well coming up next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the hidden costs of mental health. Why do we so often wait until there is a breakdown, a crisis, to get help for people with mental health challenges? If we wait that long, mental health can become behavioral health problems. We're talking about substance abuse and life-threatening challenges. That conversation with some experts in the field next hour.
Inside a rundown building in Newark, New Jersey, there's an experiment with sophisticated temperature, lighting, and plumbing controls. It's a vertical farm.
The plants are really getting a white glove lifestyle experience. They have people catering to their every need.
I'm Melissa Block, the hopes for indoor farming. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. Fox News determined 10 candidates that will debate in Cleveland tomorrow night on the main stage. It's Donald Trump, Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Mike Huckabee, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Chris Christie, and John Kasich, and those who won't, at least in the main stage, I should say. There is an undercard 5 p.m. debate, and that will include Rick Perry, Rick Santorum, Bobby Jindal, Carly Fiorina, Lindsey Graham, George Pataki, and Jim Gilmore. Now, you just heard Ted Cruz invoked on this program as a chance to sort of galvanize some support as we lead up to the caucuses and primaries. And Ted Cruz speaks very openly about a number of issues, including his faith and his announcement for the, running for the presidency. He shared a story about how his own father was essentially ready to leave the family and had a religious conversion. And he talks about why this helps drive his own faith and why he will never shy from talking about it. This is Ted Cruz talking about faith.
My father gave his life to Jesus Christ. And God transformed his heart. And he drove to the airport. He bought a plane ticket. and he flew back to be with my mother and me. There are people who wonder if faith is real. I can tell you, in my family, there's not a second of doubt. Because were it not for the transformative love of Jesus Christ, I would have been saved and I would have been raised by a single mom without my father in the household.
That's Ted Cruz talking about his own personal story, his family story, and you can hear that had a lot of appeal to the audience there. Jesse, does he have a chance to kind of gain ground in Iowa, hit the ground strong in those states, and maybe win this thing?
Yeah, I do think that Cruz has the opportunity definitely to be a stayer in the race. I think he has the opportunity to hang around through some of the early contests. He certainly has the type of conservative social issue, bona fides that you're going to need in those early races. I would say this about Ted Cruz. I think two weaknesses in the way I would take a look at it is, one, Ted Cruz's biggest his biggest liability may be Ted Cruz. He doesn't have the best message discipline outside of a scripted speech like that. He tends to want to throw red meat, and in a primary, it's good to throw red meat. But at the same time, you also have that amount of restraint because you do recognize you're going to need to pivot. Once you get to that general election, you do need to pivot. And a certain amount of selecting a party's nominee at the end of the day is electability. It's going to be a factor, especially as the further we get into this process, is this an electable candidate? That's going to be important. I think the second thing about Ted Cruz is experience. And it's not just the experience, his governing experience. Experience of your team matters too. And I'll pick up just on a very small anecdotal thing that I took notice of from his announcement. Very, very well-prepared, well-delivered speech, I thought. I love the fact that he didn't speak from a podium. He actually walked around on stage.
It was very comfortable.
Very comfortable. A lot of people compared his speaking style to Ronald Reagan, which I thought was a little bit too much, but, presents very well. Small little thing. Spent most of that speech with his back to the camera. Now, it's a small thing. You wouldn't notice it much, but it makes it very difficult. It's tough for the TV to use that coverage the next day. It's tough to actually spin it off into a campaign ad if you're going to use it. An experienced campaign, an experienced candidate, they don't make that type of mistake because they've been to the big show before. They've been in the bright lights. It's the minor details that make a big difference, especially in a crowded field like this. And Cruz to what was a very impressive, very underdog type win in that Senate race in Texas. And he deserves credit for that, but doesn't necessarily have the experience yet with the bright lights, I think, to be able to be ultimately the nominee in the long run.
Tom, does he appeal to you and young Republicans?
It's really divided among young Republicans between Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. But I think that Ted Cruz has some advantages that Rand Paul doesn't. Number one, he's got money. He's got a lot of bigger kind of donors backing him. He's got the staying power that Rand Paul doesn't have because Rand Paul's trying to run again for his Senate seat. And I think that going down the road, if he loses in early states, he might drop out prematurely before he picks up some traction. So I think that Cruz has the definite advantage over Rand Paul as far as going forward. And going back to what Jesse said about him kind of not playing, in the limelight, the thing about Ted Cruz is he can use that to his advantage. I mean, what's his campaign slogan? Make D.C. listen, and we're going to stick it to the Washington cartel. So he can say, listen, I'm not here to please the media. I'm here to please the people. That's why I'm kind of talking to the people more than the cameras. And I think that kind of appeal for an anti-establishment GOP electorate, at least in the primary stages, is going to play very well.
Okay. Tim Nealon, does he have can he be moderate enough to win a general election? Can he win the primary?
I don't see him winning the primary. I take both points very, very seriously because I do think he's got the backing of some big donors that are going to help him. He can speak from the immigrant experience, from his family past. I think the point, though, is that he is perhaps his own worst enemy and that as a debater, he tends to be a little bit much. And I think that if you were to pit him in a smaller debate, not where there's 10 with 1-minute responses, that personality clash might be jarring on some of the electorate.
When you say a little bit much, you mean affected? Are you saying you're not buying it?
I think aggressive. I think aggressive.
Don't forget that
you also have to be likable. I mean, we're talking about electability. There's also likability, and that's the problem with Donald Trump. Is I don't think he's that likable, and I think that has to be a serious. And I think that speech that he gave was great. I felt like I was listening to the Family Life Network, and that would work very well with many evangelical Republicans out there. But again, he's got to get beyond the primaries, and there's other people who can ring that bell and sound that message and who've been in governing longer with longer records. Senators have a hard time establishing a record since most of the time they stand around making speeches and then voting for things. Whereas I think governors have the ability to say, well, I affected change in the following ways. I had to deal with these budgets. I had to do X, Y, and Z. The weakness on governors is international experience and foreign policy experience. And you never know what the game changer is going to be next summer before the election. We certainly didn't expect the economic meltdown in 2008, right?
Or how about 1992? Right. I mean, George H.W. Bush never would have thought when he was riding a huge wave of support in his first term
that
he would be...
Right, exactly.
He'd be out, yeah.
Well, and again, that had to do with economics. It had to do with the rise of Ross Perot. It had to do with some of the culture war conflict that broke out again in 92 that summer, the L.A. riots and some other things. It had to do with hurricanes, Hurricane Andrew. I mean, there were so many things that just killed that candidacy. But you're right. And so, again, if you're listening to this, we're not predicting the outcome. We're saying that from this position, based upon good poli sci, each of these panelists are political scientists. This is what the metrics would tell us. This is what the past would tell us. But we don't know what's going
to
happen.
And to Tom and Jesse's point about why Scott Walker is a pretty good bet to be the candidate, you look at Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is more to the right evangelically than Scott Walker, but not to the point where Scott Walker can't hang with that for an evangelical crowd, and yet Scott Walker is governor, has that kind of executive experience that Ted Cruz doesn't. So anybody who says, well, I'm going to vote for Ted Cruz because I'm pro-life and he's pro-life, that we line up on same-sex marriage, we line up on all these things, Scott Walker is probably going to be able to check those boxes too. So by the end of the hour, they may win me over that Scott Walker could be the candidate. Tom, you want to weigh in before I grab another phone call?
Yeah, just quickly. I think that Ted Cruz is really going to shine during the debates. I mean, when he was national debate champion at Princeton and Harvard, something we've got to remember, I read an article that said that one of his famous trademark moves in a debate was he would let his opponent pick which side they wanted to argue, and then he would hold the paper up with either the pro or the con side and tear it up in front of the audience. What the audience didn't know is that Ted Cruz has written both sides on one piece of paper, so he would still have the side there. So I think that he's got the showmanship to really rise during the debate. And I don't think he's doing terribly in the polls. He's consistently, depending on what you look at, fourth or fifth. And I think that he definitely has the potential to break into the top three as the debates go on.
I wouldn't take Ted Cruz for granted at all. I think we're looking at a very large field with a lot of candidates who maybe shouldn't necessarily be there. But Ted Cruz is certainly not one of those low bottom rung candidates. Not at all.
John in Rochester, you're next. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. I'll tell you, panel, the Republicans have some great candidates. It's unbelievable, the quality of candidates that they have. And I'll tell you, as far as the immigration thing goes and Trump's statements on that, I have to say they were pretty insensitive in one respect, but he hit on the head. He got my attention because he basically has said that the illegal immigrants are all criminals. They violated federal law, and I think that resonates well with the Republican base and the conservative base. The other thing is, Ronald Reagan, after he enacted that legislation or signed that legislation on immigration, I think in 1986, he said it was one of his biggest mistakes of his presidency because Congress didn't follow through on border security. And it turned out that his numbers went down, I think, on the Hispanic vote in, H.W.'s numbers went down in the Hispanic vote in 88, and it was found that the immigration reform that was pushed in 86 didn't help the Republicans at all with the Hispanic vote. I think what they need to do is rely upon the Hispanic vote, which supports legal immigration, and who will support the Republicans, and that'll probably be about 30%. And I think if they take the stance that Trump has taken on immigration, I think the Republicans will do well. What are your thoughts?
John, thanks for the phone call. Tim Neelam?
Oh, yeah, John, that was a good point. And I do think a lot of people, and there are people who stood in line and filled out the correct forms and came to the United States to the proper legal channels. There are many unauthorized immigrants in the United States. The problem with some of the rhetoric is that if there are 11 million people, you're not going to be able to render them back to their home countries without creating what could be some of the greatest civil unrest we've ever seen, because it won't just be those people. It will be many people who would be voting Democrat, who have supported safe havens and other things. I think you're talking about a policy issue that needs some sort of compromise. I don't think that you can build a wall and fix the problem. And I think the problem is systemic, that we're bringing people in. They may or may not be suppressing wages. They may or may not be working. There's a number of things going on here economically that immigrants fulfill. I think that really needs to be the discussion, not whether or not someone broke the law by coming to the country and working here and paying taxes or whatever, or doesn't work. I think that's the problem with the conversation. I dare say that many of you listeners out there have broken the law. You're illegal because you went over the speed limit. And again, it depends on how seriously you take immigration.
But let me just kind of weigh in on that point just briefly. We had a conversation on this program recently about some of Mr. Trump's comments there. And I think what it misses is this. Yes, there is a strong drug trade, and some of the people coming across are sent. Donald Trump used the word sending. Yes, and some of El Chapo's cartel and others are sending drug runners. But that's not by any means a majority of people who are in this country in an undocumented fashion. And as our panel pointed out, if you are in this country and you've got a family in this country and you're not documented, you don't have documentation, you're going to do even less to break the law. Think about it this way. If you realize you don't have registration, or you don't have your driver's license, or you don't have your wallet, are you going to blow by a police officer at 67 and a 55, or are you going to go about 54 miles an hour and a 55? It's the same mentality. Most of those, which is why people who are in this country who were not born in this country, technically illegal or not, have a lower crime rate. So, yes, is there some crime that is very serious? Yes. But I don't think that, I think that's why that rhetoric ultimately, and especially in a general, doesn't fly. Am I wrong, Jesse?
I think this will be a shocking surprise, Evan, but sometimes politics and policy are two different things. And so I think, I think it's a little bit, you could almost go back to a situation where whenever there's a showdown over a government shutdown, you could pull a certain percentage of the GOP populace, and they would tell you, shut down that government, show Washington, make them rein in the belt. And then as soon as images pop up of kids waiting at the National Zoo, holding onto the bars, or, VA hospitals shutting down, or any of these things, all of a sudden, public sentiment shifts rapidly, extremely rapidly. And I think that we're dealing with a very similar situation here. Could it be a pragmatic political decision for some of these folks to take a position that, you need to remove, folks who've come here without following the proper mechanism from the country? You can make that position, and it may earn you a couple points in a primary, but I think you're going to need to defend that down the line. And if it were ever come to a point where that was being executed, you're going to deal with those images of children and families being separated, and the plane flights and the boat rides and everything that comes with that. And so I think we need to remember that sometimes there are certain positions that you need to take in a primary. And then there's usually what comes after that is a course correct when you head into the general election, where all of a sudden the candidates start to moderate a little bit and the positions are a little bit more mellow. So I think right now, absolutely, is immigration going to be an issue in this campaign from the primary through the general? There's no doubt about it. But they're hot button issues for a reason. And the reason is that there aren't easy answers. But I would agree with Professor Neelam that if you're looking at it from a pure policy perspective, what is needed is probably a compromise. Now, how that happens in the political realm, that's hard to tell.
Well said. This is Christian in Pittsford. Go ahead, Christian.
Yes, hi. I just have one question for the panel. Do you think that because there are so many candidates running in the Republican race and that the Republican Party is now so divided that it kind of is so doomed for a general election for Republicans and that the Democrats will win?
Christian, thanks for the question. I don't see any reason to think that just because there's 17 candidates now, I mean, there will be one candidate eventually. Professor Nealon, historically, is there any reason for that to be a concern?
Not at all. No. It's just, I mean, it just shows the, you know, once again, we're maybe moving away to a more candidate-centered electorate, and that's fine. These things will work themselves out. Remember, we've got until January before we get Iowa and New Hampshire and then South Carolina and Florida coming right after that in February. So I think these things will work themselves out. It's actually healthy to have debates. It's healthy for the electorate to have choices. Options are good. As long as you don't have, you know, a real divisive struggle in the primaries, that really is the problem. So once we get to March, it really would be nice for the party to have a candidate, sort of designate. But right now, this is healthy. It's good. It shows that, you know, there's a variety of different kinds of Republicans out
there. Sure. And once we get to March, Lindsey Graham and Jim Gilmore will not be candidates. That might be true by the time we get to September, and hopefully it is. But, Tom, any concern about the number of candidates in your party?
I don't think I'd be a Republican if I said that there was a concern about the number of candidates. As a Republican, we're supposed to be free market people, and I think that there's a free market of candidates if you want to look at it right now. They're all in competition. They're all – it's a war of ideas, and I don't see it being a problem at all. I think that it's just good, and it just strengthens the eventual nominee for a general election battle against a Democrat.
In Fairport, this is Bernard. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, I appreciate this conversation, and of course, in a year from now, you can have it again, and it'll be probably completely different. But my point is, or my concern, I guess, is I'm not interested in the games that get played to become the president of the United States. What I'm interested in is, of these people, are any of them going to be good for the United States? And so it seems to me, and I realize this is very difficult, we need to focus on not only, you know, whether they believe in God or not, but are they prepared to do something? Do they have good ideas? Do they understand the problem? And so it seems to me we need to become more focused on what government does, not on how politics works. I think the statement of politics, political science is kind of it's a joke. I'm more interested in what they're going to do, not whether they believe in God or not. Well, and that's the discussion I'd be interested in hearing.
Bernard, I appreciate the phone call as always, and I think it's a fair point. I think on this program we've really tried hard over the last 18 months to do not very much horse race and do a lot more substance. A good example was last year you had Paul Ryan come out with an anti-poverty plan that included prison sentence reform, which has typically been an idea sort of more championed by the left. But we said we don't care where the idea comes from. We want to talk about it. We talked about Elizabeth Warren's college debt relief plan. So we're going to try to continue to do that. But, Bernard, I do appreciate that point. And so Jesse is someone who works in politics, and you've talked about how the game is played.
Yeah.
But I take his point. I think it's a fair one. We can't just talk about what's going to win an election. We should talk about what should win an election, what should be good for the country.
Yeah, and I think, you know, our discussion here kind of revolves around some of those things that go on behind the scenes and that people who are going to be running these campaigns and reacting to these campaigns need to consider. But that's certainly not what the vote should be about. That's not what voters should be considering as they're heading to the polls. You know, that's a very, very different thing. And I think the last two callers almost hit on a very important point. You know, the point about, are there folks in this field who could do this job? And is the field too big? And I don't think the field's too big. And I do think there are candidates in this field who could do an excellent job. And I would actually argue that because there are several candidates in this field who I believe have the experience and the you know, the chops that it'll take to be an executive of the world's largest democracy, I do think that the healthy debate that will happen as a result of having so many candidates in the field is nothing but good. And that's exactly where you know, this opportunity to vet those candidates will come through. So right now, you know, we're talking about how the field is shaping up and who might break through and who might not. But the time will come where we're talking about, okay, who stands where on what issues and who is best prepared to lead.
Right. Okay.
May I just say, Bernard, to Bernard, actually, this is what the debate is about. It really is about what government should do. And I think that that's one of the things you have to think about is we're debating immigration and other things. What is the role of the government and what should it do? That's really what's driving a lot of the heat and rhetoric here is because Republicans think the government should do less. And how that happens, how do you maybe decouple what we've become expectations and entitlements? And that, you know, how do you, I mean, the The fight against the unions for Republican side is because they believe the unions are standing in front of and barricading real reform and change. And so I really do think that beyond all of this light and heat is really something substantive. So listen carefully.
Yeah, and I think I don't want to speak for Bernard. I think what he hears is the word pivot, mm-hmm. and you tack to one side, whether it's left or right in the primary, tack to the middle, and that feels disingenuous.
Okay.
And I do take that point, and I think it's incumbent on all of us to try to stay with the issues, but we're going to try to do a lot more of the, here are some people who write about policy in a way that I think is effective. Daniel Larson, Ross Douthat, Ezra Klein. I want more of that than Mark Halperin. Let me just put it that way. We have enough of the horse race. So some quick final thoughts. We've got about a minute left. I'll start with the professor. Quick thought on expectations for tomorrow. Let's go 20 seconds each around the table.
Don't waste your time talking about Donald Trump. For heaven's sakes, you have 1 minute. You have to declare who you are, and then you give him 30 seconds rebuttal if you mention him by name. So my expectations, tell the voters who you are.
Okay. Tom?
I think that Donald Trump, unfortunately, is going to be center stage tomorrow, and I think that he's going to take away from the rest of the field and that the media is just going to focus on, hey, Donald Trump said something stupid instead of Jeb Bush said something interesting about immigration, Ted Cruz said something interesting about the Constitution. So try and block Donald Trump out and focus on the issues, and I think it'll serve you well.
Jesse?
Yeah, I think the Trump sword cuts both ways. And so I would say that the one benefit of tomorrow night is that I think you will have more eyes on this debate than you would have
agree.
Otherwise,
agree.
Which
I
is
agree.
Good for the Republican Party, good for smaller government, good for lower taxes, good for more jobs.
Well, thanks to our panel. And if you called the program this hour and couldn't get through, try to take as many calls as we could as we talk about the first Republican debate tomorrow night. It's in Cleveland, Ohio. The undercard, if you want to see all 17, if you're up for that, it starts at 5 p.m. and then Fox has the main event tomorrow night from Cleveland. Our thanks to our panel. Tim Neeland is the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. Always great to have you, Professor.
Great to be here.
Tom Hebert, nice to meet you. Greece native, treasurer of the College Republicans at American University. We'll talk to you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jesse Slazer, leader of the Irondequoit Republican Committee. Let's do it again, Jesse.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, short break. We're talking about the hidden costs of mental health next hour.